Even if you're doing no retention marketing, like you don't have an email list, you don't have SMS, you don't have nothing. If your business is healthy, some of your new customers are still going to come back and buy from you again. I think product can be a huge lever in paid ads performance. Even if you think you know what your hero product is, it's worth testing other things. It's like if people don't find a reason to buy from you again in 30 days, they kind of forget about you, even if they liked it. You kind of train your customers how to behave. So if you're constantly putting discounts in front of customers, they're going to be discount prone and you might turn a potential full price customer into a promo driven customer.
You, as we talked about earlier, you have a lot of hot takes, a lot of retention hot takes. One of them that I love, that I agree with, but would love to hear you talk about is that most retention marketing destroys value. What the hell do you mean by that? So you're saying we should say screw retention and we should just spend more money on Facebook ads. That's what I'm hearing.
You know what? No, that's not what I'm saying at all.
We are stoked. We have Alex G here. Thanks for joining, Alex.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me on. It's great to be here.
Cody has been having a lot of AI moments on Twitter today, so we briefly want to mention that. He's found an AI tool to do almost everything. He's editing ads, he's doing PMax, he's doing cost caps, all on AI.
I'm just trying to get shit done and keep getting roadblocks. And I'm like, fuck, there's got to be an AI tool to use this. No, because I'll talk to people and I'm like, and there are people who I know are actually like legitimately using a lot of these AI tools in their creative production and stuff like that. And not just ChatGPT, but using Midjourney and stuff. But to me, the use case I have is the simplest. Like, we're testing static ads and we're doing like 75 variations, five different headlines, five different images. Like, right now, we're having designer mock them all up in Figma and doing all the variations. Like, that should be the simplest thing to just kind of duplicate and just, you know, be able to just quickly replicate all of the different variations once you have like the inputs and the component parts. But I personally haven't seen anything that can actually do that. That would be my number one. And then I needed a headshot for something else. So I was like, I don't want to go to get headshots done. Some of the headshot stuff, have you guys seen? Some of them actually look pretty good.
Yes. Yeah. It's
They could
like
probably make
a
me look a lot better
filter.
than
Yeah.
like a real photo could.
I might have an AI tool for you for
What do you
that
got?
use case. Pencil. Have you guys heard about
I
Pencil?
have tried it a while ago, not recently, and it was kind of before the AI craze, but I don't know if it did what I needed. But I'm curious about now. Do you have any insight?
No, I haven't used it recently, but I'm connected with Chase and I feel like I thought that was like their core use case, but I could be absolutely wrong about that.
I think it is. I just don't know if it was like there yet, but
Yeah.
let me check it out. I trust you, so let me try check it out. But enough about AI. What are we going to talk about today, Alex? I think we should talk about retention because that's your wheelhouse. I know you. It seems like I always knew you was like a life cycle retention person, but it seems like now that you've gone freelance, you're also doing some Facebook stuff. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, I've done both in my career.
Okay.
When I was at Tibi, I managed their whole growth marketing hands on keyboard. And then when I was at Tapestry, I was more focused on end-to-end life cycle and customer strategy. So yeah, I do both, but I think for whatever reason, the spicier takes always come out of the retention world.
I love it. Yeah, I feel like your growth ones are a lot more mild. Yeah, I didn't know that. I knew the Tapestry and the life cycle part, but no, I'm super excited to chat about whatever you want, but definitely retention life cycle. I've learned a ton from you there. For the listeners, we have recently had Alex help and do a little audit of our retention and life cycle programs, and it was pretty mind-blowing. It was awesome. So I want to chat about that a little bit, but just kind of just some overall retention, you know, hot takes. So one thing I learned, I guess tell me kind of your thoughts on this. We can just piggyback, but when you kind of came in and looked at our stuff and audited, you know, I really liked how you broke things down into different types of customers. You know, one-time customers, loyal VIPs, predictive VIPs. Can you talk a little bit about those, how you see those segments, and then, you know, how brands should really start thinking about nurturing or different strategies for each? Down to Chat is brought to you by Postscript. In my opinion, Postscript is the SMS platform built for Shopify brands. To be totally transparent, we just switched at Jones Road to Postscript, and it is the best decision we've ever made. We were on a competitor before, and they started tacking on all types of fees. The platform was not being improved at all. It was just getting really expensive, and the service we were getting was you know, just nothing compared to what we've received from PostScript since being with them. The product with PostScript is just hands down the best that I've ever used. To me, it has the best integrations for Shopify stores of all sizes. It's got the best feature set. The segmentation is the easiest and most powerful. The pop-ups are great. But really, the thing that I love is I've never experienced such great service from a software provider. The only time I heard from our previous provider was around contract renewal time. But with PostScript, they've gone out of their way above and beyond to make our program uber successful. And it's really evident that they care about us getting as much value out of our program as possible. So in my opinion, with PostScript, you get the best product on the market, you get it at the best price, and you get it with the best service. There's a reason why the fastest growing Shopify brands like Dr. Squatch, Native, Olipop, Feastables, and now Jones Road Beauty are all using PostScript for their SMS program. Sign up for PostScript today to take your SMS program to new heights.
Yeah, so I think loyalty is really interesting because it's a word that you hear a lot in a lot of different contexts, but you never hear a hard definition around it. And so I like to quantify loyal customers as someone who is on average, they have greater than 50% chance of coming back and buying new again. And if you have really sophisticated AI, speaking of AI, you can model it out on the customer level. But if you're not there yet, another thing that you can do is just look at average behavior over time within your customer file. Like how many of every 100 new customers, how many make it to a second, third, fourth, et cetera, purchase on average? And then where does it, that 50% cutoff happen is like the moment when the customer becomes loyal.
So you got loyal customers. How is that different from a VIP?
So a VIP is, just to make things simple, I like to say a VIP is in your top 10% of customers. In terms of like, do I want my top 10% in first order spend versus 6 month spend versus annual spend? That kind of depends on the brand's own financial goals and like what they're optimizing for. So if you're optimizing for 6 month LTV, you look at 6 months. So it's just your top 10% based on it in whatever time period you're looking at.
And I think one times customers is pretty obvious. Hopefully no one needs an explanation there. But so what are some strategies? How should you think about them differently? Are people likely to respond to different strategies and programs?
Yeah, so VIPs are just built different. For most brands, they come in and they spend their first purchase average order value is at least twice of any other customer you're bringing in. So to a certain extent, they're just rich people, or they're people who are like really passionate about your category. So the best thing you can do to get more VIPs is to figure out how to speak to them and basically create a VIP lane within your acquisition strategy.
So those are, you're not really creating a VIP. Like there's not much I can do to get somebody to spend that, but it's more about finding more people that are already like that.
Yeah. I think first purchase AOV is a good indicator. Like if people come in and they're in your top 25 to 30% of your first purchase AOV distribution, they're kind of like a probable VIP. So you should really try to market to those people, like try to get them to sign up to email, prioritize them for post-purchase direct mail. But you're not going to turn, so if someone comes in and they buy one unit at 50% off, you're probably not turning them into a VIP.
Yeah, so don't even try, but it might make more sense to put a little bit more money, a little bit more effort into a potential VIP, knowing they already have a high likelihood to spend more. If somebody spent more money on the first purchase, it's likely that they have money to spend more overall.
Right.
And how would you market to a loyal person differently? Say it's not a high AOV, not a, you know, the top 10%, but they've made multiple purchases. They've made three or four purchases with you. They're likely to purchase again. How does your strategy differ there?
So thinking about, you know, what type of offers or products or messages that you're giving to, if someone has one or two lifetime purchases, I say they're in the nurture phase, and then three to four, although it's different for every brand, but typically by purchase 3 to 4, you're in the loyalty phase. Your nurture customers are still kind of, they're almost wary of you. Like you can't go all in on, you know, your entire product assortment, your biggest bundles, your most complicated buy more, save more offers, because your nurture customers are still going to be kind of low context. They're still like, well, what even is this? Maybe I saw this really cool product like on a website I read, and I saw one Facebook ad and I bought it. So you have to, you almost treat them like a new customer. You educate them more about that hero product, and you keep everything pretty simple and like think about them. Like, why would you care about me?
Consider them like a retained customer until they've made multiple purchases, not just one.
Right. And then once they are in that loyalty zone, that's where you can start, you know, basically like going into cross-selling, introducing new categories, even, you know, making offers that are a little bit more complex than like, you know, 20% off of everything. You can just, you can expose them to a greater variety of what you're selling and like a greater variety of brand narratives, and they'll still respond to it.
So that makes sense. I love that. I really like just the methodology and like the methodical thinking of different ways and different strategies, and not just bucketing people in the same and treating them differently. It makes sense if you think about something that has a variable cost like direct mail, that you don't want that to go to everybody, but you might get the most efficiency, you know, going after somebody who has spent over, let's say, $100, if your average order value is, you know, $50 or $75, but has made one purchase. It's probably likely that, you know, that could be a good segment to go after. So love that. I think that's something that you helped us kind of prioritize and think about. You, as we talked about earlier, you have a lot of hot takes, a lot of retention hot takes. One of them that I love, that I agree with, but would love to hear you talk about, is that most retention marketing destroys value. What the hell do you mean by that?
Yeah. So most retention marketing destroys customer lifetime value potential because a lot of brands measure retention the wrong way. Even if you're doing no retention marketing, like you don't have an email list, you don't have SMS, you don't have nothing. If your business is healthy, some of your new customers are still going to come back and buy from you again. So that's the baseline retention rate that you need to understand. And marketing is successful when it lifts that baseline rate. So if you're not measuring that, if you're measuring it on a last click basis, you're kind of measuring, you know, did people respond to the specific marketing campaign, but you don't understand what would have happened to those people if they never would have received the campaign.
This is great. And this is excellent timing, because I literally this morning just recorded a podcast completely about incrementality with the founder of House, which is kind of a tool we started using, but he kind of explained incrementality on the paid media side. But I think it's an amazing thing to kind of tie it in on the retention side as well. So you're saying most people look at last click, not really looking at retention, and they just look at kind of channel performance, which is not the best way to look at it. Is that a harmful way to look at it?
You know, it if you're using last click, like last click analytics or in-platform analytics to manage your email and SMS, you're optimizing towards short-term objectives. So giving your entire email file 50% off the entire site is going to drive amazing last click performance. Sending a ton of emails is going to, the more emails you send, the more people are going to respond to emails. It doesn't tell you, you know, it doesn't tell you what those customers would have done if you would have done nothing or would have kept things at the status quo. So if you put, I mean, a simple way to think about it is you kind of train your customers how to behave. So if you're constantly putting discounts in front of the customers, the ones who stick around are going to be discount prone, and the ones, you know, you might turn a potential full price customer into a promo driven customer. And last click is just going to tell you, you know, what messages or offers are people most reactive to in the moment.
Without telling you anything about their true retention and lifetime value, but just of how that specific email performed that day.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And then also not looking at anything with margin as well. And it's just looking at, you know, revenue, which is something like, well, Eli and I will talk about a bunch. So what is the way to do it? Is it, I don't imagine it's looking at Klaviyo attribution or PostScript attribution. What is the way to do it?
So this is where things get a little complicated, because so measuring this stuff with complete accuracy is like an analytics headache, and a lot of smaller brands, that's not the best way to invest their time. Like if you're doing $5 million a year, you don't need a customer data platform or a data scientist. I mean, if there are easier ways to measure this stuff that are plug and play, then they should reach out to me, because I'll give you a shout out, but I don't know of any right now.
I want to talk about that in a minute. Once you finish, I want to talk about that in a minute.
Okay. So if you're a smaller brand, I think your best bet or your best way to invest your time is just to go about things with incrementality in mind. Like make sure that you have a good basic email program. Like you're collecting emails, you're not being overly aggressive with your first purchase offers. You're sending emails that are like actually readable on mobile and click through to your website, like all the real basic stuff. And then really focus on the customer experience in the first 30 days post-purchase. If you're a really high AOV brand, you might extend that to like 45 or 60 days, but you just do things that I've analyzed a lot of businesses, and that recency window is just really, really important to, like, if you're going to buy again, a lot of customers are repurchasing in that recency window. So focus on that.
Which is kind of counterintuitive, don't you think? Like, you wouldn't think that most people would buy. I know, again, any business I've kind of been involved with and looked at, it's been the case. But like, you wouldn't think that's the case. Like, you would think people need to replenish and go through their products and stuff like that. It's really interesting and
yeah.
I think is eye opening for people when they first see that.
Yeah, and I think it's almost a mental availability thing. For like when I talk about the first 30 days, it's mono brand e-commerce. So it's like if people don't find a reason to buy from you again in 30 days, they kind of forget about you, even if they liked it.
That is fair. That is fair. All right. So going to the incrementality. Yeah. Like, why is that so hard to do? Like, we're using House for paid media, and like, you know, usually you need a warehouse and a data science team or a CDP. Like, why can't you do that in PostScript natively or in Klaviyo super, super easily? Do you think these platforms don't want you to do it for some reason?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think incrementality is complicated to explain to people. I think every marketer or performance marketer should understand the incrementality and how to do a holdout test, but it's we're not there yet as an industry. So when you're thinking about selling these tools into people, last click or in platform is easy to understand. To do incrementality, you have to take in a customer's entire transaction file. And you have to say like, okay, customer A received this campaign. Now we have to track all of their activity over the next 30 to 60 days. So you even ingesting that data set it takes up a lot of, like a lot of customer data platforms charge you based on how much data you store in there. So like it's a cost center.
I'm optimistic about Klaviyo being able to do this. I know that, you know, they're building out a standalone CDP and they've got a lot of like the features now. I'm pretty optimistic. I also feel like I have seen it somewhere that they are going to build out like incrementality testing into it. I could be totally wrong, but I thought I saw like a product kind of roadmap screenshot somewhere.
I hope you're right. I mean, that would be a total game changer.
Yeah, especially as they're trying to move up market a little bit.
Yeah.
All right, let's hear some more hot takes. Eli, what do you got? What do you want to know about and set Alex off on?
My favorite kind of thing you go after is loyalty programs. I think that any retention marketing manager, day one, they hop on the job, they're like, we are creating loyalty. Buy six, get the seventh free. Or like, you get points, you use the points. I'm curious, A, your thoughts on loyalty programs. B, where all these case studies are coming from, where like this brand did $1 zillion in revenue from their loyalty program. Like where is the disconnect here? if it doesn't work, then why is it sold as something that does work? Why are people so convinced it does work? Are they measuring it incorrectly? Just give us the tea on loyalty, your thoughts.
Yeah, I think so. The most cynical way to look at it is that loyal customers are your most reactive audience. Like when a customer reaches their fourth or fifth purchase, they're usually buying from you every 1 to 2 months. So whatever you put in front of them is going to look like it's working compared to what you put in front of the average customer or your prospect. So if I was a real crafty software entrepreneur, I would say like, okay, I'm going to sell a loyalty program. I'm going to measure it based on the performance of this audience. I'm going to say like, oh, the people in the loyalty program are much stronger performers than the people who are not. But within your own customer base, who's going to be more likely to opt into a loyalty program? Like the people who already care, who are already loyal. So it's kind of like a biased analytics situation. And once you've publicly committed to whatever loyalty scheme you decide on, it's really hard to back out of it because the people who are doing it and getting the points are going to be mad when that goes away. So it's if I was selling software, I'm like, this is the perfect way to reduce churn and get more people to opt into this. But that's a cynical way of looking at it.
So what would you do if you were me and you were Eli and we have this Facebook group of 20,000 people and growing and they want something? People are Sephora shoppers, they're Credo shoppers, they're familiar with loyalty programs or rewards programs and they want something. And these people are just like, they love the brand and the products enough to obsess about it in a Facebook group with strangers. Like, is there anything that you would do off the top of your head? Would it be a loyalty program? Would it be membership? Would it be subscription? Would it be like, what would your strategy be there?
Season 3 of Down to Chat is brought to you by TapCart. We've chatted a bunch about TapCart in the past, but they make it extremely easy to create an app that often sees higher conversion, higher AOV, higher LTV from all the folks that use it. I wanted to briefly highlight our friends Ron and Ash from Obvi. You've probably seen them on Twitter. They create a ton of magic with Obvi. Some stats that they've seen with TapCart: 100% higher conversion rate in-app versus mobile web, 95% app user retention, 15%+ higher AOV in-app, and 1.5x transactions on app for everyone on their website. If looking at these stats, their app has an impressive conversion rate, on app versus mobile web, higher retention, higher AOV, all of which, you know, increase their LTV and overall revenue. They're so awesome at creating, you know, a community and driving that community towards their app as a tool to turn shoppers into brand advocates. If you've not yet checked out TapCart, check them out today and get up to 2 months free when you sign up. It's tapcart.com/down-to-chat, tapcart.com/down-to-chat. Now let's get into it.
I think the only way you can know for sure is to test. Like, I would say survey your customers first and see what they're most interested in. And then pilot the top three answers, but do a private holdout test and don't tell the people that they're part of a loyalty program. Like, take an audience of everyone who's made at least 3 purchases, split it in half, send half of them, you know, offer proposition A, but just say like, but don't say it's part of a program, and then see what the lift is. And use that to see, like, sometimes what people say is different from what people do. So that will give you a sense of like what's really effective. I think there are also almost like creative loyalty programs that have nothing to do with promos or rewards. Like, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the brand Lennox, that it's like porcelain, like plates and silverware and things like that. They do an ornament every year. So they make like the ornament of the year. And that's a loyalty program because people are coming back every year to buy this ornament. They're probably going into the store and buying other stuff. So think about like product or merchandising levers that you can use to drive loyalty too.
What about membership programs? These are another one of those things that are becoming more talked about and pretty hot. You got any opinion about them for a DTC brand?
I think it can be really effective, but it depends on kind of like the underlying behavior. Like Amazon Prime is a membership program. That's really effective because they sell everything. So if I'm like, oh, I paid this one-time fee and I get free shipping, I'm ordering at least something from Amazon at least once a week. So like, this is actually a real big value add to me. Or I know Restoration Hardware has one. Their AUR is so high that getting 10 or 20% off all my furniture purchases, even if I only buy one thing, that's like $200 or $400 of savings. So that makes sense immediately. So you have to think about how do you really deliver value to people with what you're offering.
So behavior then first, right? So you're almost thinking like customers have to be driving that direction and this membership program is giving them the reason. Like Sephora is a good example of just, you know, membership loyalty in general, because like you're saying, they have so many different options. You're buying this stuff regularly anyway. You may as well go there if they're giving you something back versus, you know, I think the weird example that comes up very often is like Madewell, right? They have such a great loyalty mm-hmm. program, but it's like, if you don't love Madewell jeans, you're not necessarily going to buy things from them just because you invested already. I think like the sunken cost fallacy is taken a little far with like, if you have a t-shirt membership, you're not like, you're only going to buy everything from there if you love the brand and the products enough. I think it's like a survivorship bias also, where like we only talk about the ones that work. And we never talk about the membership programs that are just like a waste of time and money.
Starbucks is a bank, guys.
Yep, you're right. That's the most commonly referenced right. Starbucks and Sephora. But yeah, no, I also agree and see as a retailer, as a marketplace, it's a completely different offering than as an individual brand.
Yeah. You almost have to think about like, what is the customer's next alternative? Like for Sephora, it's probably Ulta or something similar. Like, how are you going to increase the person switching costs for you guys? Right. You're the only place they can get it. So the value proposition is a little bit different.
So you're saying we should say screw retention and we should just spend more money on Facebook ads. That's what I'm hearing.
You know what? No, that's not what I'm saying at all.
I'm kidding.
Especially at your size. But you,
I'm kidding.
Retention is more about what are the little tweaks and things that I can do right to kind of like clear the plaque out of my customer life cycle so more people are flowing through there.
And we briefly touched on this, but I want to kind of address the other side of it. Like people, you know, like all the agencies on Twitter are always like, send more emails. The only way to drive more revenue is send more emails. And we briefly touched on the kind of like the idea that like, yeah, it's possible that sending more emails will drive more revenue. You have no idea if it's like actually impacting anything beyond kind of like what you're seeing today. Like you have no idea if they wouldn't have purchased without it. Is there like, what's the downside to sending just a lot of emails to a lot of people? Like if more emails gives me more money today and Klaviyo is not charging me much more money to send more emails, like is there a, what would you tell a business that's just like, I send 6 emails a day and I'm JCPenney and I love it?
Honestly, I would just say like, you know, God bless, but there's nothing I can say. There's nothing I can say to a business like that, because that is the terminal point of the send more email strategy. Is like you paint yourself into a corner where the only thing that you can do to make revenue go up is to send even more emails. And then you hit a ceiling of like human resources where you have a 25 person email team and like it just becomes this behemoth program. And then you still reach the point where like that's the only arrow in your quiver is to send more. Because if you're sending 3 emails a day, tweaking your post-purchase series is not going to do much. And it gets into, you start getting into like it's hard to prove the opportunity cost of all of the subscribers you could have retained if they weren't alienated by receiving 3 emails a day. So you, it's one of those situations where it requires such monumental change that there really has to be like a big problem driving it. Like something has to be really, really not working for a brand in that situation to be able to back off of that approach. So my perspective on it is, for the vast majority of your God subscribers, bless, just don't start. don't be thoughtful about how many emails you send a week.
And does SMS same thing? Any changes apply there? Just same thing.
Well, SMS costs you money, so people are usually a little bit more disciplined with that.
That's fair.
I think the most, at least for me personally, I feel like SMS is so intimate that I am very, very thoughtful about which brand. I subscribe. I have almost no brand sending me SMS, but I
subscribe
know.
I unsubscribe to almost everybody.
Yeah.
Isn't it wild that we're three marketers on a call and we all don't subscribe?
I actually was just thinking about it, and I unsubscribe from pretty much every email as well.
I have a separate inbox just for email. Yeah,
if I was still doing any email marketing, then sure. But now I'm like, I want as few emails as possible.
Are you guys inbox zero or no?
I am inbox failing to be zero. I got down to like 10 last night. I tried. What are you, Alex? I feel like you're either zero or you're like 4,900.
I try to be zero, but this is actually really bad and something I have to change, but I use my personal email for business. So it becomes my to-do list, but it's a mix of like bills I have to pay, like business stuff.
And oh, that's just chaotic.
It never gets to zero, but yeah. It's.
You got to split them up. I have like three different inboxes. That way, if I have like 10 in each, it doesn't feel as bad as having like 30 in one.
Yeah.
I don't know how people go.
These are the pro tips.
Eli, what do you have?
I was just going to say, these are the pro tips that people come here for. Split your inbox to three. Mm-hmm. That way it doesn't feel super bad. My inbox, my personal inbox is like Alex, like a to-do list. My work inbox, I'm aggressive with. Like I probably now have three emails, but it's either archive or snooze or deal with. It's like, it drives me crazy. Like that to me at the end of the week, I really need to get it to zero. But I think the dissonance is so weird. Is like, I've never spoken to an email marketer that is subscribed to all these emails. They all find them annoying. They find them aggressive. We all make fun of Wayfair, and we're all slowly descending down that mountain to become the next Wayfair, where we put emojis in every subject line. We send three emails a day. Everything's closeout. Everything's last minute. I think it's just interesting. And we're so like, there's such a massive dissonance, which is weird. Like, we know that it pisses us off when we get three emails a day, but we're like, oh, well, we're definitely going to do it because it drives more revenue. So I think it's a funny one.
Some people just really like email, or their relationship to the inbox is different. And sending an email is almost like sending an ad impression, where it's almost like they zone out on anything below the fold in their inbox. So they're like, I'm never going to reach inbox zero. So you just send it 3, 4, 5 times a day, hoping to be there when they happen to open it. Like there's actually a segment of every channel audience who's just their number one fan. Like, I'm sure there are people who want 5 SMSs a day. There are people who want an entire feed of ads and no real content.
That's me. Oh, I want pretty much the only thing I go on like Facebook for, the only reason I have it on my phone, to look at our Facebook group, or I want to see ads.
Yeah, I'm getting there.
I would pay Mark Zuckerberg $10 a month just to get a Facebook feed of ads.
Does I hope he's weird? Listening oh, right now.
Yeah. All right, Alex, what are your other hot takes? We got probably like 15 minutes left. What are your other? I know we talked about a few before the show.
Let's see. Okay, so we talked about loyalty. We talked about people measuring retention wrong. It's not really a hot take, but I'd love to spend a little bit of time on merchandising, because it's definitely been a hot topic on Twitter because no one knows what it is, which is fair.
I was going to say, you're going to have to start by defining that. I mean, I know I'm familiar, but like, it's not something outside of fashion that people in e-commerce really talk about.
Yeah, it's... And honestly, it's weird, because in traditional, the four P's of marketing, product was one of the P's. So like, historically, marketing had some say in what products were developed, which makes sense because they're supposed to be closest to the customer. I think in fashion, merchandising evolved into a separate discipline, because part of it is like, it's the person who's translating the designer's vision into something saleable, which you used to be able to get away with. But I think in today's day and age, the brands that need that are struggling. when I talk about merchandising, I kind of talk about, it's another way to talk about the traditional 4P product, but also like how that kind of intersects with selling things online and selling things through digital marketing channels.
Tell us more. Go off. I want to hear more. So how should let's say you're a marketer, how in a DTC econ marketer, how much involvement, how much say should product should you get, and how much should you be thinking about it, or what are really like the levers there to help your marketing metrics?
So I think the biggest, most helpful things to know are, as a marketer, your job is you put bestsellers in your high cost channels because bestsellers make your conversion rate go up. And you also need a strategy to turn high potential new products into tomorrow's bestsellers. And that doesn't necessarily mean paid social, although it can.
Let's be honest, DTC, we're talking paid social.
Yeah. So that's like the number one role of marketers in the merchandising process. It's also, I think it's a little bit different depending on the nature of the business, like how big your assortment is. When a brand is smaller and the assortment is smaller, I think marketers can also use insights on, customer reviews, customer response to the product, pricing, to help guide like what gets developed next, or how should the brand expand its product line. When the assortment is bigger, that does kind of become its own job because there's just like so much product being developed.
That's fair. I can share a little bit about how we do it here. So we have product development. They make all the products. They do get amount on the ops side as well. And then like the marketing calendar is co-owned by myself and chief product officer. So, we're both on the C-suite. We kind of do it together. They are obviously very familiar with what we are launching, with creating the new products, that roadmap. So we'll talk about that, kind of set it annually. And then, we'll both try to bring insights that we have, marketing looking on obviously, what revenue and spend and customer LTV things. And they might look at more like a unit, sales analysis. But we'll kind of do that together. And then like, for example, one great takeaway, kind of obvious one, but really great takeaway from your audit that you did for us is, we should pretty much be doing more kits, and the more kits we have or the more cross category shopping we can encourage, the better that is for LTV. So I took that and we plan to have them for about 3 to 4 months. So we always have one going and merchandise them with, let me know if I'm using this word correctly or not, with, products from multiple different categories.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's really great. Like that's hand in hand, like product development, merchandising is like how things should be done. The reason I harp on it so much, or like the reason that it's become kind of a thing for me, is because I've been in brands where they have decided to like make a big pivot in the merchandising direction, but they expected it, essentially like whenever you do that, whenever you make a big change to what you're selling and the nature of the product or the price, you're going to churn out a lot of your existing customers. So you have to be confident that it's like your new direction is going to be advantageous to your acquisition, or you basically just need like a really good reason to do it. And you have to be prepared to rebuild the business like what almost from scratch, which this
Stop
brand
would carrying a
SKU. Yeah. So price changes, there's this concept of like willingness to pay. So everyone has a top price they're willing to pay for a given item. And you can kind of like test into that. Like you sometimes see some conversation around that. But if you're selling something, if most of what you're selling is $100 and then you decide like as of June 1st, everything new that we're introducing to the site is $300. That audience you developed at $100 is probably not going to come along with you because you've like busted out of their willingness to pay threshold. Formulation, if you actually are making the product better, then that's not necessarily a churn driver. if you're completely changing direction, like you used to be a vegan brand, but now you're a,
well, I think happens,
you're making it out of lard or something.
Very anecdotally, but in fashion, not that I work in fashion, I've seen people talk about it. Like it might be like J. Crew and like, you know, it seems like people, like a lot of times people will, it looks like trying to make their margins better or as they scale, it's like the quality goes down. I guess that's kind of what I meant. Or I've seen like an unnamed beauty brand recently kind of get some bad press for reformulating some of their best-selling products. And, you know, then there's a lot of social posts and TikTok posts about how it's not nearly as good.
Yeah. I mean, if you make something worse and try to charge people the same amount, it will usually make them mad.
No, but it seems like marketing, let's say you have merchandising, let's say you have product team, like it seems like there are probably some gray areas and it's important for like those teams to work super well together.
Yes. That's very true. And your strategy, no matter what size the brand, your strategy kind of has to be driven by your top acquisition channel. Especially in DTC.
I would agree. I would absolutely agree with that. And yeah, I think what you said about how, I forget how you said it, but you know, your job as a marketer is really to sell the best sellers and put your best sellers on your main channel and not try to sell the other ones. I mean, like, I don't care how good you are at paid social, like you're going to be way better at selling what people really want and what they don't want. And, you know, I can say like 95% of our spend is on one single product. And, you know, there's not much that I can do to get the other products to perform the same as that. So we'll use, again, I think we can do other things with kits and stuff like that, but we'll use other channels, a lot of non-paid channels to try to, you know, promote that, the other stuff. But it's really hard to run paid acquisition on some of these things that are not a bestseller or might not have the same margin profile.
Yeah. I think product can be a huge lever in paid ads performance. Like if you're even if you think you know what your hero product is, it's worth testing other things.
Have you ever had that happen where you think you know for a brand and you know you run it for a while and then you test something else and that thing takes off better?
I think so. I've mostly worked with like fashion footwear and accessories brands. And the process that I typically recommend is that you go into the season and you just try to get a read on every product. Like you shoot some low lift assets not every single SKU if you have hundreds of SKUs, but like a representative batch. And as you go through the seasons, you start to get a handle on like the characteristics of products that typically perform better. So you can use that to narrow what you're testing. But you get that early read and then you try to invest more in producing assets around the styles that are working well. You almost never know. Like sometimes bestsellers come from nowhere.
It's like I'll do a bunch of like mentor pass calls with people will book and like I'm a little bit at a loss in some of them because I don't have that much fashion experience. And I feel like what works in other niches, like usually it's like, hey, you've got to hook test video, you've got to do landing pages, stuff like that. Fashion is like so different. What do you find works and what do you find are the available levers, maybe top three things you'll focus on with like Facebook acquisition for fashion?
So this is actually the topic of my talk at, I think it's the North Beam Media Buying Conference coming up later this month. So so definitely go there if you want to learn more about media buying for fashion ads, but top things are honestly like product trumps almost everything else. Like figure out what products work because you can run the most unoptimized ad with your best seller and it will beat out the most optimized ad with like something that is on the long tail of your assortment. Typically collections pages outperform landing pages for fashion because it's very, and it varies. Like there are fashion brands that are more more features benefits focused. Like if you think about Duluth Trading Company and those ads, like they run on TV, it's like they're boxers that my butt doesn't sweat. Like if you have a story like that, then you can try to lean into more of the best practices that you hear about media buying. But if it's truly, I like it, I see it, I like it, I buy it, then it's kind of like, you'll do better if you just expose people to a broader assortment of product, like hook them in with the bestseller. They show up, maybe they're iffy about it, but they see something else.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah, it's just like, the, to me, the rules are so different if it's not a problem focused thing. And what you're selling is so different that you've just got to kind of show it, and you've got to have like really good brand at that point.
Yeah. I mean, fashion is tricky. Like, they call it fashion risk for a reason, but there is definitely a way to put some data around it, or put some systems around it to reduce that risk.
Totally, totally. Eli, you got any last questions or thoughts for Alex?
No, I think we are, I want to make sure we give you some time to plug whatever you have going on. Where can people find you? Where do people sign up for the newsletter? One of my favorites in this space. I honestly, it's probably my favorite, but if I say that, then I get in trouble with Cody. So I say it's one of my favorites.
Well, thank you. I subscribe to both of your newsletters as well. They're always super value add.
Thank you.
Additive. So if people want to get more exciting content about retention hot takes and media buying for fashion and all that good stuff, follow me on Twitter. I'm at Hey, It's Alex P, as in Peter. Or you can check out my website at nobestpractices.co, and you can sign up for my newsletter there.
And I would highly recommend doing that. Like Eli said, it's definitely one of the best newsletters in the space. Read every week. One of the few that I actually read every week. So totally would sign up and recommend that. But yeah, Alex, thank you so much for joining us. This was a blast. This was a pleasure. Super excited to kind of work through all of the changes from the audit. And, you know, for anyone who is looking for some retention help, highly recommend working with Alex. It was super thorough, and it'll give you a ton to work through. So don't want to hard sell it too far, but definitely have learned a lot from you, and super happy you came on and joined us.
Yeah. Oh, and I'm on Mentor Pass too now. I almost forgot about that one. But if you're looking for if you're a smaller brand looking for like a deep dive into your retention, some actionable tips, I'm on Mentor Pass as well.